Hey, it's Bill Radke. You're listening to KUOW in Seattle, and I'm glad you are. I hope you can stay with us. You may have just heard that President Trump's son-in-law says that he told the Senate today he did not collude with Russia. The New York Times columnist Tim Egan will give you his take on this big week in Washington, D.C., where Congress members are making some big decisions before they head home to their districts. So we'll talk Russia and healthcare and other stuff with Tim Egan in about 25 minutes. And I hope you'll join us on Twitter, too. The conversation continues there at KUOW. Okay, first topic today, high school sports are so frustrating. We want our kids to have fun, to learn lessons, hopefully get a scholarship, or even play professionally. But are we really helping these students, or are we exploiting them? Consider this stunning fact. On the 2014 Garfield High School basketball team that won the state championship, every one of the starting players was listed as homeless. What's going on here? Here to tell you how society's best intentions can get turned upside down is Seattle Times reporter Claudia Rowe. Hi, Claudia. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So you write about this federal law that is meant to help homeless kids play sports. How is this good intention being turned upside down in Seattle?
The gist of the law, which is called the McKinney-Vento Law, is that it allows kids whose families might move around from shelter to shelter or friend to friend, couch to couch, they don't have to keep switching schools as their families move. That was the concept of the law, to give kids some educational stability. Essentially, it blows up the usual rules that bind kids to their neighborhood school.
Because to play on a team, you've got to live in the district, right?
Purportedly. However, for a number of children, a number of students, I should say, and they're mostly young men here in the case we're talking about, the law has been turned upside down in the sense that they don't have to abide by the usual transfer rules that bind athletes. So usually, if an athlete is switching schools and switching teams, they have to sit out a season, but not if a student has McKinney-Vento status. It's called a hardship exception. And the idea is to give kids in a bad spot a break. It also applies to their grades. So normally, an athlete has to maintain a 2.0 when they play in Seattle School District, but not McKinney-Vento kids. They can play with lower grades. So, again, opportunity gives kids an incentive to, in fact, come to school, right? But then what seems to be happening is that there's not enough support on the back end so that these students end up, when the season is over or high school is over, with grades too low to really do anything else. And we know how poor the likelihood is of, in fact, making it to a Division I university or a pro team.
Right. So will you paint us a picture here? What is the typical profile? How would a school put a player on a sports team, a player who's officially homeless, but maybe not really homeless?
The McKinney-Vento law covers a broad range of living situations. So many of these students are not what some of us might think of when we think of homeless. They're not living necessarily in a tent by the side of I-5. They are shacking up with friends, with relatives. They're moving around a lot.
But that is a real kind of homelessness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just not what the average reader is going to picture when they're thinking homeless youth. Mm-hmm. They're going to think about a kid who's sort of wandering around the streets. McKinney-Vento applies to any young person who does not have an adequate, stable nighttime residence.
Okay.
And so, student shows up at school, and what's becoming clear through the reporting in this story is that it is possible for athletic directors to make a notation in the school system that designates a student McKinney-Vento for purposes of athletic eligibility. And that doesn't necessarily filter down to the district office and headquarters where purportedly students are getting vetted with, you know, much closer scrutiny.
So one way this could be exploited is that this federal homeless designation allows a student athlete to have terrible grades and still play.
Correct.
And you also write about cases in which it sounds like this student wasn't homeless until they left their families to come to Seattle and play sports.
That is correct.
How does that work?
Well, in the few cases that I highlight in the story, one young man came, actually two, came from Beaumont, Texas. Both of them were designated McKinney-Vento, homeless. They had families in Texas. They came up here, they say, at the behest of staff and parents affiliated with the athletic department at Garfield. And they were designated McKinney-Vento, homeless. They are not the only ones. There is also a student from Louisiana, from Baton Rouge, same thing. I know of another student came from Michigan. He was on that basketball team. So they have families in other places, but they're designated homeless here because they're not, in fact, living with their families. And they are bouncing around from home to home, couch to couch. In that sense, they are homeless.
And you can see how the intention is a noble one. For one thing, this law lets you play with poor grades, but it would probably be hard to study if you genuinely don't have a stable place to live.
That's what I think is the most interesting and sort of troubling aspect of the story. I think it's fine to give kids an opportunity, and maybe strict readers of sports rules would argue with me. But as an education reporter and as somebody who really studies that's, you know, give kids an opportunity. Great. I have no problem with it. But support them on the back end with more than study halls required during football season. Kids in this kind of spot who have this kind of trauma going on, they need a lot more than a study hall.
Okay, so maybe there's a solution. You're saying not necessarily repeal this law that was meant to help homeless kids who want to play sports.
Correct.
But maybe if they get this federal designation, then maybe along with the law could come some kind of required extra help even beyond their playing careers?
Sure. To be fair to the district and to adults, Washington State gets about $1 million through the McKinney-Vento law from the feds. $1 million for 295 school districts. It's not going to go very far. Okay, so the homelessness staff is under-resourced. That's one thing. Secondly, it may be possible to give a 7, an 8, a 10-year-old real deal attention. But a kid who is 17 or 18, 19 in the case of some of these players, you're thinking a 19-year-old is no longer in high school, but they are. Somebody who is 17, 18, or 19 might be somewhat difficult to case manage in the same way as a little child.
I'm talking with Seattle Times reporter Claudia Rowe. What do the Seattle schools and the school district say when you confront them with these abuses?
The district's executive director of athletics acknowledged, he conceded, yes, there are holes in this law that could be exploited. The district's deputy superintendent said that he is concerned, that they are concerned about the information that is starting to come to light, both through their own looking, through what I'm presenting, and from what they're hearing. They are concerned about kids being used, they say.
You point out in your piece that most student athletes designated as homeless are Black. Why is that important?
What's really interesting here is that the local chapter of the NAACP jumped all over this initially when I first wrote the story in April about the two young men from Texas. And because Garfield's athletic staff or their football coaching staff is African-American, as is the principal, the NAACP said, this is racial targeting. And they sent a letter to the school district saying the same thing. What's interesting to me is that there is a curious lack of attention to the students in the NAACP's letter. There is no real focus on the students at the center of all this who are also Black and being underserved. That is what's so interesting. It's African-American coaches and predominantly African-American students. And you get into this gray area of, are you providing an opportunity or are you exploiting kids or maybe some of both?
Maybe someone's listening to us, Claudia, and saying, these rules ought to be enforced. But is that possible? Is the district enforcing all its rules about who can play and how schools can recruit? Or do you think the Seattle School District looks the other way?
I think that, again, there is a huge hole in the system. You have the Washington Interscholastic Activities Association, known as the WIAA. They are supposed to oversee athletics in the state. So they have their purview. The district is supposed to be watching out for McKinney-Vento kids, but they're...
Again, these are the kids designated federally as being homeless.
Correct.
For purposes
so the district
of playing
has
sports.
Its McKinney-Vento staff. The WIAA has its eligibility hearings, but they say in my story, look, really, it's member schools who are supposed to police themselves. So, all right, if you're going to say member schools are supposed to police themselves, and then we're going to celebrate these championship teams, and we are going to sort of go, hey, we're giving homeless kids an opportunity. Great. And we can sort of shrug our shoulders and walk away. Nobody really seems to be looking all that deeply at, right, and what happens when your few months of athletic opportunity go? What happens when the season is over? And nobody really seems to be looking all that closely.
Finally, then, Claudia, there's so much in this piece, so well done at Seattle Times. Is there one solution you can leave us with that we should want to happen?
I don't know if there's one solution, but a part of the solution,
yes,
surely is better guidance, better counseling, more counselors, more training for counselors. The guidance counselors at high schools are massively overburdened, and I don't think that their training is terribly deep on kids from traumatized backgrounds. They are primarily academic transcript counselors, and they are supposed to be guiding students toward completing high school and maybe going on to college. But these students are just sort of falling under the radar. Maybe a counselor sort of shrugs his shoulders and says, hey, as happened in this case, hey, I think this kid is mainly here for football. That is not supposed to be happening. No students are supposed to be in Washington high schools for any sport. And that's very, very clear in the WIAA rules.
Better counseling for our students. That answer highlights the fact that, as you and I were saying before the microphones opened, this is not really a sports story. This is about education. And our priorities.
Right. It's an education story and possibly an exploited youth story.
Claudia Rowe, reporter for Seattle Times. Always good to talk with you. Thanks for writing it. Thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks for having me in. Great to be here.
And we'll have more of KUOW's The Record just ahead. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Earlier this year, in the span of one afternoon, on the same stretch of Aurora Avenue North in Seattle, three people died of heroin overdoses. That's shocking, but it shouldn't surprise you. Last year in King County, 359 people died of drug overdoses. That number has risen every year for the last 7 years in a row. Some King County officials say they have a way to help: safe injection sites. These are places where addicts could use heroin and other illegal drugs under supervision so that they won't overdose and die. This is a false hope, according to my next guest, Republican State Representative Morgan Irwin, who's also a Seattle police officer who would like to ban these supervised injection sites from King County. Representative Irwin, thanks for coming on again.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And just to be very clear, the views that I'll express today don't reflect the City of Seattle or the Seattle Police Department.
That's right.
My own.
Yes, you're not speaking for the police department. You, Representative Irwin, have a story to tell us that illustrates why you think so-called safe injection sites are not so safe. What is that story?
So, as a police officer, I work in South Seattle, and that includes the Jungle, Jose Rizal Park, and some other places that are kind of known hotspots for drug users. And this was just a couple of weeks ago. We'll call her Sherry. Sherry's 53. She's missing her right eye. She's in kidney failure. She has a $50 a day heroin habit, and she sells herself to make that money. Sherry lost her right eye in a drug deal gone bad, buying heroin. She was trying to rip off her own dealer. She was desperate, didn't have the cash. He stabbed her in the face. That's not going to be prevented by a safe injection site. She's in kidney failure because black tar heroin, which is the heroin most common here in the Northwest, is about 15% pure, and the other 85% is anything brown and sticky. And you can use your imagination, because the dealers that make this stuff, when they step on it, they're not really focused on the health of the end user. So the other 85% that her kidneys have been filtering out for the last 20, 25 years has destroyed them. And she's in renal failure, and that's extremely painful for her because she's still basically untreated for that. She lives out of a car. She probably weighs 80, 85 pounds. Her skin is turning yellow. This is what 25 years of heroin use looks like. And when people say that there's a safe way to inject poison, there isn't. There just isn't. When you perpetuate the use cycle of an ultimately poisonous substance, or a substance that's mixed with various other poisons, you're not reducing harm.
Representative Irwin, it sounds like Sherry, as you call her, needs a lot of help. The people who want these supervised injection sites, they want Sherry to at least stay alive, not overdose, so she can get that help. What do you think that these supporters of supervised injection are getting wrong?
Well, I would say that, you know, overdoses are one facet of this. We spend, I think it's, and you can maybe have better numbers than me on this, but we spend about $200 million a year just in King County on homelessness. I think that's pretty close. Homelessness is a symptom of untreated mental health and drug addiction. So this is like spending $200 million a year on Rogaine because you're losing your hair because of the chemotherapy. We need to cure the cancer. Like, we're focused on the wrong thing here. We're trying to make it easier for people to use longer as opposed to trying to address their underlying mental health issues. And we have ways to do that, but we're not going forward with those, and that's deeply troubling.
Okay, cure the cancer. We're going to get into some possibly better solutions in the course of this interview. I want to bring in another perspective on this at the same time. Norm Stamper was Seattle's chief of police in the late 1990s, and now he writes and speaks on policing issues. Welcome back, Norm.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Officer Irwin says that preventing overdoses... that's not the same as making people safe. You heard his argument. What's your response?
It's pretty simple, and that is the circumstances of Sherry's existence, as described by Officer Irwin, represent a real human being's life story last 20-plus years in which he has been going downhill as a result of heroin addiction and the need to finance her next fix, which leads her into various activities that are both unsafe and criminal. So what he's describing is current reality. What I'm imagining and what the authors of various safe injection site programs are offering is a way to allow heroin addicts who have, in many cases, been addicted to that substance for many, many years, to come to a safe, supervised, hygienic facility and take their drug. They are under medical supervision. They are in a position to get an overdose reversal drug immediately if they need it. They are, in fact, given clean needles. So what's being proposed here is an opportunity to take the Sherrys off the streets, to make them less a police problem, less a neighborhood problem. Doesn't cure homelessness, and it certainly doesn't guarantee that somebody who avails himself or herself of those services is in fact going to seek treatment. But it dramatically increases the chances that that's exactly what will happen.
Well, it keeps them alive, but what makes you think it increases the chances that they'll get help if they can continue to service their addiction, as Officer Irwin was describing? Some people might need to hit bottom.
Yes. And in fact, in addiction theory, whether it's alcohol or any other drug, that reality is just that. It is the truth. You do have to, quote, hit bottom. Or at least for whatever reasons, you have to want treatment. And many are leading dismal, chaotic lives. They're unemployed. They've lost not only work, but they've lost family. They've lost their health, as Officer Irwin has, I think, pretty eloquently described. And they're very much in need of the kind of attention and let me just use this term, compassion, that is necessary for them to feel, hey, my life is not worthless. There is hope that I can get help. But they need to reach this level of heroin maintenance, which is a term that's offensive to a number of people, but necessary in order to create that path toward treatment.
Officer Irwin and State Representative Morgan Irwin, you just heard Norm Stamper describe a kind of compassion. What about the power of an addict realizing, oh, somebody cares. They want me to stay alive. What about the power of the healing power of that?
Well, I would say here in the Northwest, we're blessed with a lot of compassionate individuals, and that includes even our enforcement. And we don't always get the credit for that I think we deserve. But we have a tremendous number of services here in the Northwest, and one of the things where I think we really fall down is someone ends up in a situation where either through the courts or by their own choosing, they say, I really need the help, and they get into a medical detox, you know, facility, which is, you know, 3 to 7 days, depending on the type of addiction and the type of facility it is. And they even get, you know, one of the coveted beds in a rehab facility, which that's the 45 to 90 days afterwards where you learn to cope with this new life where you're not addicted. The trouble is you get out of the hospital and you are chemically detoxed, and you have to wait 90 days before that next bed opens up. And so now you have someone who chemically, yeah, they've moved off of the drug, but emotionally, physically, they don't have that support structure yet. And I guess this is what I'm saying. We're going to spend about $6 million on these injection sites, and where I'm getting that number from is the Canadian injection site in Vancouver runs about $3 million, and we're saying they've done it for, you know, a number of years. I guess you would assume they've got the costs kind of where they're going to be, and we're going to put two of them in King County. So if we're going to take that $6 million, why not build more rehab beds? Why not build more facilities to help people get off of this drug, as opposed to just helping people continue their addiction? Because every drug deal that they do, every time they meet a dealer on the street, you know, that's one more time where, yeah, they're not overdosing, but they are absolutely taking their life into their hands, and there is no backstop for that. There's no naloxone for gunshot wounds.
Well, then let's say more about this safe injection site, supervised injection site in Vancouver, BC, because, again, the proposed injection site for King County would be the first in the United States, but we have this close by example in Vancouver, BC. It's called Insight, and former police chief Norm Stamper, that people point out that area in Vancouver is still crowded with addicts overdosing right outside the facility. So what makes you, where's your evidence that it's helping?
Well, the bottom line is no single person has died of an overdose who has used the facilities at Insight. I have visited that program. I have spoken with addicts who have availed themselves of the service there. I've also done the same in Sydney, in Australia. The programs that began as long ago as 30 years ago in certain European cities, in Zurich and in Bern, Switzerland, have proven to be lifesavers. And they have established, as a result of the services that they provide, an avenue to treatment, to recovery. And an astounding number, to use one nurse's comment, of people who otherwise simply would not seek help have done just that.
Are you saying Switzerland's doing something that Vancouver, BC is not doing?
Well, Switzerland's definitely doing something that BC is not doing, and that is they're furnishing the heroin. Not only are the addicts given clean needles, they are actually given the heroin. So its purity level, as Morgan was talking about, is guaranteed. It's assured. It establishes a maintenance level. And if you understand addiction theory, if you understand how people can be addicted to a drug for as many years as Sherry has been, then you can appreciate what it means to get them to a maintenance level of a guaranteed quality, which stabilizes their otherwise very chaotic and very sad lives. And it eliminates the need to prostitute themselves, to steal and fence stolen property for a nickel or 50 cents on the dollar. It eliminates the need for them to engage in street robberies and other criminal activities in order to finance that next fix.
Officer Irwin, what do you think about that idea of not just supervised injection, but where people bring in their own drugs, but providing drugs that are pure of a guaranteed quality, as Norm Stamper was describing?
I think I got lost here. We were talking about injection sites. Did we just say that the goal of the injection sites is to legalize heroin?
Norm, is that really what you're saying? In effect, we ought to legalize heroin?
Well, I didn't say that, but people who know my views on the drug war understand that the drug war has caused far more harm than good. Drugs are more readily available today at lower prices and higher levels of potency than in the entire history of the drug war, which now dates back over four decades. So people know my view, and that is that we need to replace the prohibition model with a regulatory model. We need to treat people who are addicted or otherwise experiencing problems with any substances in their lives as the medical patients that they are rather than criminals.
So now, Officer Irwin, we've widened out the discussion. We'll come back to these proposed supervised injection sites, but what about the idea that prohibition doesn't work whether we want it to work or not?
Well, I would say that Chief Stamper, defined a DEA agent or a narcotics officer or even a line-level officer in the United States today that's talking about the war on drugs. I mean, that has not been a term we've used in close to 10 years. I haven't been a cop for a full 10 years, but that's not been a focus, and it hasn't been a focus in a long time. We've been focused on trying to build better communities and to protect those communities so that they can grow and be vibrant, and that's been from the top down 4 years. So the kind of the prototypical Nancy Reagan war on drugs model, that's been dead for a decade. But I guess what I'm hearing, and maybe it's because I'm just, you know, a simple guy, but was that the next step after safe injection sites is legalization and even government providing heroin to people. And I didn't expect the conversation to go in that way, but if that's where we're going with this, not only am I a no, but I'm an even more vehement no than I used to be, because that heroin destroys people. Destroys people. And we're just talking about their actual health, you know, the addict's actual health. Then there's all of the things that happen around them, where they're stealing from their own family, where they are committing crimes on the streets, where they end up passed out in bushes. You know, this is, like I said, I didn't expect this to go in that direction, but if that's the direction that we're going with this...
Okay, you're a no vote. You're a no vote, and I don't expect the two of you to agree on legalization, but we're running out of time now to just come back to supervised injection. So Representative Morgan Irwin and Seattle Police Officer Morgan Irwin, not speaking for the police department here, there may be a ballot initiative this fall to prevent these injection sites. Supporters just turned in their signatures today. If not supervised injection, can you give us one solution? You said more rehab beds. Is there anything else our listeners should know that would be a better solution than this one?
Absolutely. More rehab beds and more focus on mental health. We are here in King County spending $200 million a year on homelessness. Let's spend part of that money on stopping it. Let's get people off of these drugs. If we want to reduce harm, we get people off heroin as soon as possible.
State Representative Morgan Irwin from the Seattle Police Department and the Washington State Legislature, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And then finally, Norm Stamper, what's your final word as people, you know, these signatures have been turned in today. There might be this ballot initiative. What do you want to say to someone listening right now who might be filling out a ballot on supervised injection sites in King County?
I think it's important to recognize what has not worked and the power of ideological purity. In other words, drugs are bad. We must criminalize them. We must criminalize the people who use them. And in the process, we're essentially perpetuating exactly what our current conditions are. And nobody would argue that they're good, that they're positive, that they're healthy. I need to clarify one thing. I'm speaking for myself and certainly not for anybody on this side or that side of a ballot issue when I talk about the European model of legalization. This initiative is all about ensuring that people don't die and that they're given an opportunity to begin that journey toward recovery.
Norm Stamper, former chief of the Seattle Police Department in the late 90s. Thanks for coming on again and talking about this live issue. The King County could be the first place in the United States to go for a Vancouver, BC type model and allow these users to inject heroin or other illegal drugs under medical supervision. Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
And I would love to know your thoughts as you've been listening to this discussion. We are on Twitter right now, at KUOW. You can email us, record@KUOW.org. We began this conversation with the story of Sherry, this user who we've given the pseudonym of Sherry. I bet you have your own story. We'd like to hear it as we continue this conversation. You can leave us a voicemail if you like, 206-221-3663. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. By the way, we just had Seattle's former police chief, Norm Stamper, on talking about supervised injection, and I didn't mention that he has a book out called To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Now, let's turn to what's happening in, as they say, the other Washington, quote, "I did not collude. All of my actions were proper." That is what President Trump's son-in-law says he told the Senate Intelligence Committee today. Jared Kushner testified behind closed doors about the Trump campaign's relationship with Russia. And this is an important week in D.C. on that and other fronts as well, because Congress is about to leave on summer break on Friday, so they got some big decisions to make. And we want to fill you in now with the New York Times Seattle-based columnist Tim Egan. Good to see you again, Tim.
Great to be back with you, Bill.
This morning, President Trump tweeted about, well, first of all, let's talk about this congressional investigation, which is, it pauses for a month, right, after Friday, Jared Kushner and otherwise. How important is that for the investigation? What's the meaning of this Friday deadline?
It is important to keep the big picture in mind because these things come at us so fast with the Trump administration, we kind of forget about where we are.
Yeah.
Up until just a few weeks ago, there was no evidence, and that was the talking point, that no one in the Trump campaign had met with any senior officials from the Russian government and that there was any evidence at all of collusion. Then this story was broke by my newspaper about this initial meeting with the lawyer who had heavy connections to the Russian government, in which they offered dirt on Hillary Clinton. Don Trump Jr. was the organizer of that meeting with the email subject lined dirt, something really, generically said something like, "I've got really good stuff on Hillary,
right,
believe it," and saying it was a top government official. So the stories moved very quickly from there was no meeting to there was a meeting to we talked about adoption, Russian adoption, to now, today's sort of closing out of it, because again, Congress will take off for all of August and this will end this phase. Although Mueller, the special counsel, of course, Robert Mueller, will continue his investigation. But the closing out is important because Kushner, the son-in-law of the president, issued this statement saying, yeah, we had this meeting, but I quickly realized nothing was going to happen. So I had my aide, I emailed my aide and said, phone, call me now so I can get out of this meeting. He said it was a waste of his time. Nothing happened. Well, you had all these top-level people in the room with a lot of information apparently to share on Hillary Clinton. So we'll see if the statement is enough to maybe pause the investigation. But this is really where it pauses for right now. There's going to be some more closed hearings later in the week. Now, we still have—
Why are they closed hearings?
Yeah, that was just the way they negotiated. It should be of utmost importance to the American people of whether our election was, you know, hijacked by a foreign government, and a foreign government that is hostile to us. Shouldn't we be able to hear, you know, what all the facts are on this? But that, apparently that was a condition of negotiation for appearance. Now, Don Jr. and Paul Manafort, the former campaign director for the Trump operation, are still to testify in closed doors in the next couple of days, and there may be public hearings when they return. Now, what's interesting is, as these people go out on recess, do the American people care? And I'm not sure that's the question, because this is not a popularity thing. This is a serious, you know, attempt to hijack this democracy, and you don't really hold it up for public opinion and say, well, what are the polls on Russia these days?
Are you saying members of Congress might not be eager to move on this if they're not getting pressured from their constituents?
Correct. Because one of the
It's summertime.
Right.
We got stuff to do.
Right.
We got barbecues.
We got barbecues. We got baseball. We got all this. So people are saying, some of the members came back. They did get an earful on another thing we hope to mention, what happens to Obamacare. All of them got an earful on that. But a lot of the Republicans said, well, you know, wherever I went to the county fair, to my town hall, no one brought up Russia. But again, I don't think it's something that you hold up. You know, you answer to the Constitution on this. You don't answer to the opinion polls. You know, this is a very serious, unprecedented thing that we never come close to having before. And we have to at least close the narrative on this, what really happened.
So you don't think public outrage matches Tim Egan outrage at this point?
It certainly doesn't. And I think what will drive, you know, at least we have bipartisan support on having some hearings right now. And, it doesn't match it, because Republicans tend to not care in the polls.
Couple things. Do you believe the rumor that President Trump's about to fire Attorney General Jeff Sessions and replace him with Rudy Giuliani?
So every hour almost, I think that Washington can't get more fascinating and bizarre. So just to back up that, Trump tweeted today that my, quote, beleaguered attorney general.
He called his own attorney general beleaguered. New York Times
exactly.
Job to call
he seemed
him beleaguered.
To throw him under the bus. And he said, why isn't he investigating crooked Hillary? Now, just pause for a minute, Bill. Again, never in our history have you had a sitting president call on his attorney general to launch a federal investigation of his former opponent in the last campaign, which he won, by the way, and you could just move on. So that's just the stuff we missed in advance of this. Now, I don't think Sessions is long of this world. I really don't. And the rumor today has been, would Rudolph Giuliani, who is very much a Trump loyalist, would he ever take over? Well, Giuliani would have to take a pay cut. He also is ethically challenged on a lot of things. I don't think he could get full Senate approval. And finally, about 10 minutes ago, he told CNN he wasn't going to take the job.
Oh, I hadn't heard.
He wasn't interested in the job.
Okay.
But Sessions is clearly not long of this world. The poor guy, you know, he recused himself. And Trump wants someone in charge of the top law enforcement officer who's loyal not necessarily to the Constitution, but to the president.
You mentioned health care. The Republicans' Senate health care bill has been pronounced dead, but there's still a chance for some kind of vote this week. What's going
to
happen?
Right. So there's two things for your listeners to follow. The first vote is tomorrow. That's on whether to go ahead. And you need a bare majority to go ahead and then have a vote. So it's whether you'd have a debate. They don't apparently have the votes on the vote to go ahead. But if they do, they would vote apparently on just a pure repeal of Obamacare. Now, one of the interesting things, without a replacement, that of course would possibly leave as many as 30 million people, not the earlier 22 million people, in the lurch. One of the interesting things that happened in the recess, and I only know this because I spent a lot of time years ago in rural America and I follow their news.
In the recess, meaning when Congress members were home in their districts.
Is a lot of the Congress members and the senators from the heartland, from the Midwest, from the Great Plains states, heard from these small towns where the hospital is the only thing going. The hospital is, you know, there's two things that keep small towns alive. They call it meds and eds. You know,
if you've got schools.
If you've got a school and you've got a hospital.
Yeah.
And these hospitals are entirely dependent on people coming in with the health care they now have through Obamacare. And this is why Senator Moran of Kansas, turned into a no vote. He said, there's towns all over rural America that are basically going to go under if you pull the plug on Obamacare, which wasn't part of the debate. But that's one of just the small things that you can see. So I think in this vote tomorrow, they probably won't have enough to proceed. They'll call it a day. They'll go home for the recess. That leaves us with, I think, a really dire thing, though, still. An administration actively then working to dismantle and hurt what is left of Obamacare. So without a replacement, they can nick away at it and do some pretty serious damage to it.
We'll see what happens if at any town halls that the Congress members, if it's not just their own private beach goings and barbecues, but if they hear it from constituents, we'll see what they hear. Finally, we just have a minute left, and you were telling me about how the West Coast looks on its way to becoming its own nation state. Will you tell me what you mean by that?
Yeah, that's something that deserves a longer topic because I want to develop it for a New York Times piece too.
Okay.
But it's just look at this. Last week, California voted to extend its climate change stuff until 2030, a cap and trade program. They're the world's fifth largest economy. And when you look at all of the West Coast, which is solidly Democratic, of course, we will have a vote in Washington State here soon on the Senate. We'll determine that. You have a president that has never been in the mountain time zone, let alone the Pacific time zone, since he's been president. In the absence of that, the left coast, the West Coast, is really going its own way. And climate is only one of the most obvious ways. Again, with this much economic power, with this much population base, they can basically go beyond the Paris Accords and go around what the president has been trying to do. But you're right. It deserves a some amplification.
Well, one question. I know California can make car manufacturers change because they want to sell cars in California. But how much power do states like Washington and California have when it comes to something huge like climate change?
If they join British Columbia, which is we already have sort of a loose, because they're two sovereigns, you can't really do it. We have a loose sort of non-binding pact and Oregon, and you have a solid wall of arguably the most prosperous area in the world right now, with new cities looking to tomorrow, saying they will go one way. That bully pulpit power goes well beyond the things you mentioned about car manufacturers and cam trade. It just says we will not follow, our president on this. And this goes beyond Cascadia too. I mean, it's the West Coast and British Columbia. Of course, in Canada, you have a prime minister who's also on board as well. It's not just British Columbia. But I think it's the consolidation of that. It's the message power of that. And they're trying to do a similar thing in the East Coast right now with Chris Christie's soon to be leaving the governorship of New Jersey with his 15% approval rating, off to the beach, no doubt. They're going to have a consolidation on the East Coast as well.
I see President Trump just tweeted, failing Tim Egan is on the lefty coast, who I don't care about. Sad.
Sad. Yeah. I just sold 100,000 more books because of that. He doesn't tweet about anyone in the West. We're not part of the
Club.
The furthest West he's been in his presidency is Iowa.
Come on, Mr. President.
Right.
Sit down with me and Tim Egan.
Exactly. Come out and look at the part of the country that you rule. That's the prettiest part of the country right now.
New York Times columnist Tim Egan about to throw out the first pitch at Safeco Field when?
Tomorrow at Irish Heritage Night against the Boston Red Sox. Everyone come out and please don't boo if I throw a dirt ball. I've been practicing. I'm trying to make sure I get a strike.
Wait a minute. Haven't you written about the Irish? Are you of Irish descent?
Oh, you wouldn't know, would you?
And you're throwing out the first pitch against the Red Sox?
Yeah.
I'd like to know where your loyalty stands, sir.
Dual loyalty.
Dual loyalty.
I'm Irish America, but they won't be with the Red Sox, I'll tell you that.
Okay. Tim Egan, good to see you.
Great to be with you, Bill.
Thanks. More of KOW's The Record. Prepared recipes at your door. Then what are you going to do about it? Stay tuned. KUOW is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. If a box showed up on your doorstep with all of the ingredients you need to cook a meal, does that mean you would cook? Companies like Blue Apron and Sunbasket are betting you will, and now Amazon's making that bet too. They've just launched their own meal prep delivery service. I've never used this before. I want to open up that box now and see how much convenience and flavor is inside all of that plastic packaging. My first guest is Kathleen Flynn, graduate of Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School and teacher of home cooking classes. Her website is called Cook Fearless. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thanks, Bill.
Does a Cordon Bleu graduate turn up her nose at a meal in a box?
Well, that is so funny that you ask, because I had a bunch of readers who wrote me and said, hey, if I use Blue Apron, am I cheating?
Am I cheating? Good question.
So I thought, I want to give them a proper answer. So I actually signed up for Blue Apron and also Home Chef.
Okay, Home Chef.
And I tried both of them.
Yeah, what'd you think?
So I actually thought that the quality of the ingredients was really good.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of packaging. I was very put off that as a, you know, eco-Seattleite.
Well, you'd have to be a ton of packaging for right. 2 ounces of this and a cup of that.
Right, yeah, exactly. Like a single clove
yeah.
in a little tiny plastic bag. And I was like, oh, this is killing me. But
right.
But the recipes were very straightforward on Blue Apron. They are not fast food. It takes 35, 40 minutes for some of these meals.
Good point. It's not that convenient. I mean, it's convenient, but right. to
it's
a point.
And I think really what it does is it answers two things that really are difficult for home cooks. One, finding a recipe. I mean, if you put in chicken cordon bleu, for instance, mm-hmm. into Google, you get 400,000, you know, hits.
Ways to do
so
it.
How do you know what recipe to choose?
Yeah.
I think that is one thing. And I think the second thing is, you know, shopping. I mean, we have kind of the lost art of shopping, really, mm. in terms of groceries. And people get very confused. They don't, like, oh, you know, or they think this is just too much. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to buy a whole thing of parsley, and what am I going to do with the rest of the parsley?
Yeah, they might be right.
Yeah. So, okay. that does solve two issues for them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think it's cheating, and I really hope that maybe a positive outcome of that is that people who feel like they can't cook or they feel like they're not confident in the kitchen will get these kits, do it, and be like, really not that hard to sear a piece of chicken or roast some vegetables.
Okay, so a qualified thumbs up to the idea, it
right.
sounds like, of a meal in a box. Okay, mm-hmm. and more to say about that. Also with us is local food and travel writer Naomi Tomkin. Hi, Naomi.
Hi.
You have not used these kits yourself, right? So, but you seem a thumbs up on the idea. Tell us your take.
Yeah, a lot of what I have to say is similar to Kathleen. I think that there's two pieces that I look at it. One is you have a lot of people that are coming to this not from they otherwise would be cooking meals in their kitchen that they shop for fresh,
mm-hmm.
but that they otherwise would be picking up takeout, fast food, buying really packaged foods
mm-hmm.
that they just take home and eat, not cooking. So this is step one to getting those people into the kitchen. And even just as you were saying, seeing what happens when you put heat on a chicken breast. And it sounds bad, but that is step one in learning to cook, is understanding what heat does to an ingredient and what happens when you add salt to that chicken. And they're still going through that process. It's just helping them to do it.
Okay, so at least we're cooking.
Yeah.
All right, that's
yeah.
a start. You also said, Naomi, that these kits can bring some equality to the kitchen. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the other piece of this is that anybody can do it, and I mean that in the most unintimidating way. Cooking is something that has always been very intimidating to everybody. And when you're not learning it in the generational, handed down from mother to daughter way, it's even harder. I personally mostly learned to cook from Food Network. So,
mm-hmm.
But if that's not how you learn to cook, then how do you learn? These meals are a way to do it, and they're a great way for people to learn on the fly. And I mean this especially as a new mom. I've watched so many other new moms that I talk to just be able to hand off the prep of dinner to their husbands who have never before cooked. And that seems really old-fashioned that the women did all the cooking.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't even necessarily that they always cooked before, but they always thought about the food. They said, here, can you make this? They said, here, can you go out and buy this? And this allows them to wholly hand this over to their husband, and they can sit and
not holding their hand the entire way. That's exhausting. Okay. Husband stereotypes aside, we are talking about meal prep delivery services, and Amazon, the Seattle zone, is in this game now, too. Kathleen Flynn, I don't want to tag you with the snob name, label, but I mentioned the cordon bleu earlier. I just wondered, what do you think it says about our culture? I guess people asked, are they cheating? Like, people want to know about what it says about them. Does it say anything about our culture that people seem to be liking these Blue Apron type services?
I think it says about our culture that people don't necessarily feel confident going to a store, picking up their chicken,
yep.
picking up stuff. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of home cooks, and the holy grail is the ability to open up your fridge, look at stuff inside there, and figure out what to make for dinner. But most people can't do that. And that's just a reality of our culture.
You're not telling me I have to butcher my own hog and cook it myself nose to tail.
That is crazy.
Because I was expecting to get lectured about too much convenience. Is this too much convenience? Are Americans doing it again?
No, I actually think that if you are looking at the options, you know, as Naomi said, right? So I would rather have somebody get a meal kit and make fresh food than go and buy a box of Tuna Helper and go make Tuna Helper. Because really, at the end of the day, you're looking at different options in terms of convenience. So wow. I think for people who also like to cook and just want to shake up kind of their routine. I mean, they've got their 8 go-to dishes that they go to every time they make dinner. And, you know, why not get, like, say, you know, Szechuan chicken or something and learn how to cook with spices and do techniques that you don't normally do.
Right. It can jumpstart your learning process.
Mm-hmm.
But Naomi, I read that most Blue Apron customers cancel the service after 6 months. What does that tell you?
So, I mean, I think that part of it is that it's a progression. It's step one in entering your kitchen. And I've heard from friends, but I have heard that they do it for a little while and then they have some idea of what they're doing and maybe they can imitate the recipes that they have made before, that now they have a couple recipe cards from their Blue Apron meal that they're using, and so they've taken that first step and now maybe they're on to buying their own ingredients.
Yeah, and I think the other notable thing is that Blue Apron makes all of its recipes available. You don't have to necessarily be subscribing to the service, and I would say compared to, say, Home Chef, I thought that the recipes on Blue Apron were much more reliable. I thought that their portioning was more appropriate. I just thought they felt like they were tested a lot better.
We have one more minute, so very quickly, which is more of a fad, meal prep delivery services or the slow food movement? What's more long-lasting? What's more of a fad?
I think meal delivery services. I think there are so many players. You know, the Blue Apron stock price is not going gangbusters.
Uh-huh.
I think we're only just at the beginning. I think we're less than 5 years into this as a business model, and I think that people are only going to continue to improve upon it. Google was not the first search engine, and I think that we're going to see a lot of new players coming in. Amazon's just one of many.
Food and travel writer Naomi Tomke and Kathleen Flynn. Her website is called Cook Fearless, and you got a couple books in here. What's the latest one? Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good?
That's it.
Thanks for coming and talking about meal ingredients in a box. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Bon appetit. Enjoy. Thanks for listening.